Okay, tonight's lesson is number 14, and I got three parts that I'd like to cover. One is the protocols of the elders of Zion, and then we're going to talk briefly about the First World War, and then we'll talk also about the Balfour Declaration. They're not, you know, the Balfour Declaration in itself, when we get to it at the end of the lesson, is not something that is directly related to the history of anti-Semitism. But it is related to the birth of Zion. It's related to the growth of Zionism and to the birth of the modern state of Israel, and all those are kind of intertwined. And as it relates to a massive immigration of the Jewish people from Europe, and actually the Balfour Declaration, in a sense, shows us a little bit about how the Jewish people could and could not immigrate exactly the way they wanted to at the time they. The critical time in history when they should have been able to immigrate, so to Israel. So we'll see that. But so it's somewhat related. The first thing I wanted to talk a little bit about, maybe more than the others, is the protocol of the elders of Zion. We covered that that book covered, meaning we discussed it in passing. I think probably in the first couple of the second or third lesson early on. I had showed you some covers, and I told you about it, and I said I would get back to it, and here we are. We're back now. We're, the reason why we're talking about it now is because we are in that time in history where the book actually came to exist. So the exact title is The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. One of the biggest hooks in the history of anti-Semitism is a pamphlet called The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. It was presented as being the minutes of a late 19th century meeting of Jewish leaders planning to take over the world. Actually, some even presented it as the minutes of the first Jewish Congress in Basel, Switzerland in 1897 that we discussed, I think, last week. It first appeared in Russia from a government press in 1905, and the Russian mystic Sergei Nihilus, you have a picture of it on the bottom of the page, a blatant anti-Semite, was responsible for the first publishing. He was not responsible for the making of it, but for the first publishing, making it available to those who wanted a copy of it. The original work was chapter 12 within a bigger book from Nihilus entitled The Great Within the Small and Antichrist, an Imminent Political Possibility, Notes of an Orthodox Believer. Don't ask me exactly what he meant by that title because I'm still trying to figure it out. But that was just the title of where the book came from. He actually claimed that the book had been read secretly at the first Zionist Congress in Basel, 1897. I just mentioned that. So now that book, you know, how did it come about? Well, the original work is dated between 1897 and 1903, possibly from author Pyotr Ivanovich Rachvovsky, head of the Paris office of the Russian secret police. It was with the help of others. It was quickly recognized that the book was a forgery. Actually, it was in 1921, just a few years after it started to be being published. It was mostly plagiarism based on two previous anti-Semitic works, and it was basically exposed by many experts from various countries, starting as early as 1921. The two books that were used were Dialogue in Hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu by French writer Maurice Joly, which was a satire on Napoleon III that was written in 1864. And then another one called Biarritz, which is Biarritz is a French town by the sea, right above Spain on the west coast of France. Biarritz by German novelist Hermann Goetze in 1868. The protocols are the best known example of forgery, as well as one of the earliest example of conspiracy theory. They are filled with cliches and platitudes on how to take over the world while never containing any details or specifics. So there's no dates really, no location, or it's painted with broad stroke, and it was really easy to for experts back then to look at this and go, it's a forgery, it's a hoax. Yet what's amazing to me is that it continues being used. While the vast majority of scholars worldwide have written off the protocols as an anti-Semitic hoax, it continued to be used worldwide. A tragic example can be seen in the actions of American automobile giant Henry Ford. This is why I don't drive a Ford. He was, I mean, I don't know about people today, but he was a really strong anti-Semite. Henry Ford was really, from 20 to 27, Henry Ford published a newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. The newspaper published the protocols at the same time as the Times in London discredited the pamphlet. But this did not stop Henry Ford, who was quoted saying, "The only statement I care to make about the protocols is that they fit in with what is going on." It's really not saying anything, except that he's not saying I believe they're true, or even if they're false, what they're teaching is good. He's just saying they fit in what's going on. I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that, but he was giving his approval. Not only that, he was responsible for the financing and distribution of 500,000 copies of it. He, with his own money, paid to produce, to print, and distribute 500, that's half a million copies. Back in those days, that's a lot. 500,000 copies of the protocols. Much of the articles published in the Dearborn Independent were also reprinted in a later volume known as the International Jew. And those articles are very abrasive, very anti-Jewish. The next page, I put some of the different covers I could find that were used for either as an inside cover or as a front cover of the protocols. Some of them on top are two French ones. The next two, I think, are in the Spanish. You've got one in German. And on the bottom left, you've got the International Jude. It's German for the International Jew, a book by Henry Ford. Now, to Ford's credit, it appears that a lot of what was written in the Dearborn Independent was not necessarily coming straight from his pen. He did not write it himself. He put his name on the paper. He published it for 8 years, and it was all gathered into the book, The International Jew, under his name by Henry Ford during his lifetime. So, you know, how do you divide the, you know, I didn't do it, I did not know, and the, I'm still responsible because I put my name on it, okay? You better be careful what you read. I have to be careful all the time when people come back to me and say, "Did you say this?" You know, like I just posted something on my Facebook yesterday about a Christian leader who's teaching that Jesus is not the Messiah. Yet he's supported by millions who send him a lot of money, and he supports Israel, but he says Jews don't have to believe that Jesus is the Messiah. So I posted that with a video of him saying it and also talking about the book I read of his. But I had several people telling me, "Olivia, are you sure of this? Are you sure it's not misunderstood?" You have to be very careful what people say and what you say they say. Because, so anyway, in this case, you know, what they say in America, proof is in the pudding. Is that what they say? Reuben? The International Jew, the one on the bottom here, it's the compilation of all the articles, of most of the articles, if not all, that Ford, under his name, published in the Dearborn Independent, which was a very anti-Semitic paper, a newspaper from 1920 to 1927. It's a compilation, it's a book made of the articles. Ruben? Right. Right.
And you mentioned about Henry Ford, I don't know if you realize this, but Henry Ford, he had merged much of his money in 1920, I think 1928, into a German conglomerate when this conglomerate was called IG Farben. And what they were doing was putting together all the steel and chemical industry in Germany to start building up what was going to end up happening. Well, that same company ended up being the company that produced the gas that was used in the Nazi concentration.
Now, the question is, did Henry Ford merge his money, invest his money in a German company because of his anti-Semitism, or was he forced to change or to develop his position because of his, you know, dealings with the German companies? It could be, either way is wrong, but it would be interesting to find out.
It was Henry Ford's cult of that.
Okay.
And that's what I thought was interesting.
Yeah, that I did not know yet. Or what I know is that he is one of 14 foreign people who have received the highest honor from the Nazi Party, which is a cross, like the Nazi cross of something. Him and the two Americans who received it are the two most famous American who are anti-Semitic, is Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh. Oh, big time, big time. And listen, I want to, you know, I don't know who's listening to this on the internet. I want to make sure that I clarify something that I've said in the past. I'm not here to continue painting the Jewish people and myself as a Jew as the eternal victims of the world, okay? I always talk about the scapegoats of humanity. It is true that the Jewish people are and have been and continue to be the scapegoats of humanity. But I don't look as a hobby. I don't look for all the people that are anti-Semitic and I go like, oh, you know, this is terrible. The Jews, you know, they're all after us. It's a conspiracy theory. This is a class about anti-Semitism. So if somebody is blatantly anti-Semitic, you'll hear from me in this class. So I have nothing against Charles Lindbergh as a person. He's done some great things. Same with Henry Ford. If we talk about anti-Semitism, I cannot go through that time of history and not mention the newspaper that he wrote, his publishing of the Protocols, and all those things. That's kind of like Martin Luther, the father of the faith, yet he wrote some books against the Jews. That's part of the class. So I just want to say that because, you know, I throw some names at people sometimes and they go like, I didn't know that. Oh, are you sure? I mean, this is pretty strong of a statement. So, you know, I just wanted to kind of clarify that. Okay, so we continue here. You know, like I said, this is not a fun class to teach. This is not an easy class to teach. Okay, it's needed though, but it's just, you know. So the Protocols on page 4 now, written to influence the Tsar against the Jewish Masonic takeover. The Protocols failed, but further damage was done that would far exceed the expectation of the original forgers. So the original idea was to influence the Tsar, but that original idea did not work. But a seed was planted, and the germination of that seed took place really with Hitler. And it continues to this day. You have to understand the Protocols are still published all over the Middle East, all over, by neo-Nazi groups and white supremacist groups. As a matter of fact, I did a check, Amazon.com, it shows up. You type Protocols of Elders of Zion, it's there. Why shouldn't it be? We live in America, and if it's published, it's on Amazon. So, you know, freedom of the press, it's got to be there. I mean, I would say it has to be there. But it's also what was interesting is that I've never seen this, and I was happy to see this. When I checked on Amazon, I didn't buy it because it's also available on the internet for free in so many different ways, and it's not worth reading, let me tell you. But there was a statement by the Anti-Defamation League and a statement by the president or the leadership of Amazon, whoever the person was, I forgot his name, both saying it has been recognized that this is a hoax, but for, because of freedom of press and because for people that do their personal research and study on that topic, the book needs to be available. So they make a statement, a clear statement. I've never seen this. It's not just like a little, do you want to leave feedback, whatever. It was a statement that you could see, like you look for the book and boom, you got this box. Statement by Amazon.com and the Anti-Defamation League. And I've never seen this on any other book. It might exist. That was my first time in looking at many books on Amazon. Yes. It's been recognized by experts as a hoax. So you wonder, when people want to believe something as truth, when they know it's been officially recognized since 1921, it's been for 90 years, okay, it was recognized as a hoax, not 10 years ago by some experts, but less than 10 years after it was published. Yes?
Going. In other words, I think it's
Spiritual. The enemy is working at it. Yeah, you know, absolutely. The enemy is blinding people. They're in cognitive dissonance. You know, don't confuse me with the facts. I can't be wrong on this because it's what I've always believed. So if the book proves what I've always believed, the book is true. Human nature is not dictating what the book is saying. So, you know, in human nature mixed with, of course, a satanic influence, definitely agree with that. But Hitler himself relied heavily on the protocols and even quoted them in Mein Kampf, praising and validating them. This is probably one of the few times you'll have me quote Mein Kampf in public. And this is what he said: to what extent the whole existence of this people is based on a continuous lie is shown incomparably by the protocols of the wise men of Zion, so infinitely hated by the Jews. They are based on a forgery, the Frankfurter Zeitung moans and screams once every week, the best proof that they are authentic. What many Jews may do unconsciously is here consciously exposed, and that is what matters. It is completely indifferent from what Jewish brain these disclosures originate. The important thing is that with positively terrifying certainty, they reveal the nature and activity of the Jewish people and expose their inner context as well as their ultimate final aims. The best criticism applied to them, however, is reality. Anyone who examines the historical development of the last 100 years from the standpoint of this book will at once understand the screaming of the Jewish press. For once this book has become the common property of a people, the Jewish menace may be considered as broken. So that's from Hitler's Mein Kampf, quoting the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Hitler is believed to have been influenced by the protocols. The book greatly helped him to rationalize the destruction of European Jewry. In many ways, the protocols were a catalyst for the Holocaust as they became part of the solution to the Jewish question. That was very important. That very book was used as an excuse by Hitler. He said, hey, you know what? You know that and the writings of Martin Luther. He said, I'm only continuing or finishing what Luther started. In 21st century, the protocols continue to be published and distributed by neo-Nazi fringe groups and radical Islamist groups around the world. The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion is classified under controversial knowledge and available on Amazon.com. This is not an advertising. I'm not plugging Amazon.com here. I'm just, you know, giving you information. Okay, but it's classified under controversial knowledge. I thought, you know. Okay. The First World War. Again, controversial knowledge? Yeah. Well, if it's not oxymoronic, it's definitely moronic. Okay, so, First World War. Okay, keep in mind that I'm going to tell you about the First World War in a page and a half. Okay, again, we're talking about anti-Semitism here. So, we're not going to talk about the First World War. I'm just kind of passing and giving you a little bit of, you know, where are the Jewish people as the First World War happens. Mind you that, you know, keeping in mind that they were, of course, at the end accused and, you know, pointing the finger. Everything that was bad throughout history was always eventually some people would come up with a great idea like, ah, the Jews. Okay? So I'm surprised. I'm sure it exists on some conspiracy website that the Jews invented AIDS. I know it's got to be somewhere. It's got to be somewhere because that's how it goes. Every big thing, it's the Jews. It's just so fascinating. And of course, you know, shame on the person who creates the hoax, the lie, the fib, but much more shame on all those who follow that person or that group and believe it's the truth. Anyway. First World War, June 28, 1914, saw the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. As a result, World War I was declared and the face of Europe would be changed forever. At the beginning of World War I, 80% of the 10 million Jews of Europe lived in the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires. The Jewish communities of Europe had been used to hardship, that's an understatement, and had endured many forms of anti-Semitism, yet the advent of World War I worsened their condition as their lives became once again punctuated by lootings, pogroms, and expulsions. The greatest hardships came from Russia, where many Jews came from or resided. even though the Jewish men enrolled in the Russian army to fight Germany, they were quickly accused of spying for the Germans. No, don't need an SCAP here, you can cross that out. Accused of spying for the Germans, and many were sent to Siberia. So I have, in my own family, my father's father fought the First World War as a Frenchman, but he was Jewish. And when it came to go to war, he said, hey, I'm a French citizen. And now we're going back to Napoleon, remember? When Napoleon gave citizenship to everybody, he said, hey, I'm a French citizen. Yeah, I'm a Jew. That's fine. I keep kosher. I keep the Sabbath. My father's dad was very pretty much Orthodox. But you know, if I have to defend my country, I'm French. I'll defend France. So he went to war for France and came back. And that's what the Jews of just about every country in Europe did. I pledge allegiance to this country. I'm a Jew at home, but I'm a German, Russian, Italian, Spaniard, French, so on and so forth. So I go with my army. Yet, when things went south, they immediately were accused and blamed of what was happening. So they were accused, Jews enrolled in the Russian army to fight the Germans, and they were quickly accused of spying for the Germans. Many were sent to the camps in Siberia. That's in the beginning of the First World War. We're not talking about the concentration camps here. We're talking about the Gulag and those camps. When Russia started to lose ground, the Jews were to blame. On the other side, 20% of the 600,000 German Jews joined the German army and served. When Germany started to lose ground, anti-Semitism came to the surface, and again, the war was the fault of the Jews. A census was ordered in 1916, followed by anti-Semitic actions. So no matter which way you look, it's like damn if you do, damn if you don't. Okay? We join the army to defend our country, and if it goes bad, it's our fault. If we don't join the army, we're probably traitors, we're probably spies, and we're going to get lootings and pogroms. So what to do? As the war progressed, Allied nations ratified various treaties and worked on agreements to share the spoils. It was soon agreed that the Ottoman Empire would have to be divided. One treaty would supersede the previous one, and by the end of the war, the British had conquered Palestine. In the midst of all negotiations, we saw a little bit of that on that movie earlier tonight. In the midst of all negotiations, Britain officially endorsed the Zionist program, and almost overnight, Zionism started to take root in the Holy Land. This was a major step in the right direction for the Jewish people, yet the surprise of a British endorsement would eventually be overtaken by the shock of a British about-face. Because the British endorsed and said, okay, we're going to do something with Palestine. But what happened down the road was not the best thing for the Jewish people. So it was good, but then it got bad. The 1919 Versailles Peace Treaty brought some hope for the Jewish communities of Europe. Eastern European Jews were pushing for their religious rights and traditions to be preserved, while Western European Jews would have settled for citizenship rights. Both were partially satisfied. Remember, we got Jewish people kind of, I don't want to say cut in half right in the middle, but we got two groups of Jewish people that kind of started with the emancipation, with the Haskalah. You've got the Jews that really want to retain the religious lifestyle and the synagogue, Talmudic culture and environment. And then you've got the Jews who say, hey, you know what? I'm ready for a modern lifestyle. Okay, I don't have to go to synagogue every Saturday. I don't even think I want to keep kosher all the way, or whatever they decide to do or not do. There was a shift, a separation, I should say, between those who wanted to retain the Talmudic lifestyle and those who said, hey, it's modern times. We have seen the emancipation of much of Europe. We also have been emancipated. We have seen some progress, and we are now accepted in society much more than we ever were. So from both sides, Eastern European Talmudic lifestyle, religious rights and tradition preserved, and Western European Jews who had gone through the emancipation and were hoping for more emancipation and more freedom, they say, hey, I'd love to just become a citizen of that country. And and so they both got a little bit satisfied, but it was still far from where it should have gone. It was not satisfying to a great measure. Additionally, all Jews of Europe, aware of their unending status of unwanted citizens, started to seek the enforcing of the Balfour Declaration in hope of an official establishing of a Jewish home to immigrate to in what was then British Palestine. As much of Europe found itself in need of being rebuilt from its own ashes, the scapegoats of humanity were once again targeted in full force. And whenever I say the scapegoats of humanity, it's a reference to the Jewish people being, you know, harassed and pushed and killed from one country to the next. Quote unquote, anti-Semitism was hitting the Jewish people from all angles, academic, religious, economic, and even racial. But the favorite type of anti-Semitism was political. Most of Europe found it easy to link Jews and communism, and succumbing to the libelous conspiracy theory of the Protocols, various governments saw it as their duty to eliminate and or restrain the Jews at a time of critically needed reorganization and rebuilding. So people started to see the Jews as communists. And there was truth to that, okay? There was something appealing to the Jewish community in the claims of communism in Europe. So they maybe some Jewish people got involved in that, and pretty soon communism is bad. Jews, we know, have been bad all along. So a Jew is a communist, it's like double bad. And then pretty soon it's like if you're a Jew, you're probably a communist. And since we hate both, that's how people start thinking. So but Jewish people, and if you have an answer to that one, please tell me, because it's a puzzle to me. Jewish people to this day, I look at America, most Jews in America are very liberal and they vote on the left. Why? I don't get it. Why? I don't get it. Oh, Ruben has... So it's Jewish people going back to the days of Roosevelt and Truman, and as almost as a allegiance to these early presidents, they continue voting on the left. I'm just repeating for the recording. That's basically. Right. Okay. Okay. You want to say something?
They just did a turnaround.
Yeah. Yeah. Yesterday or 2 days ago, with that person back east. Yeah, I know. There's been a loss of a Jewish vote. The Jewish vote is changing a little bit in this present government. But anyway, it's so basically that was a little sidestepping. Did you say what you wanted to say? I would say it makes some sense, except that 85% of the Jews of the world don't care about good deeds and sacrifice because they're not religious.
Right. But they still do. I mean, I truly believe that in this country, I don't know about it, but I do think...
No, the good deeds and the being green and all those things, and that I see that in the Jewish community, but I don't think it's related to the sacrifice and good deed, because there's only 10 or 15% of the Jews of the world are religious. So what about the 85% that like my dad was like, I don't care about God or anything until he, you know, his final days. So that to me, I don't think it would be from that perspective. But maybe a little bit more about, you know, the allegiance to the older presidents and the older Democrats back in the 40s, that's possible. Maybe that's possible. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit now about the Balfour Declaration. This is an important paper. It's not very long, actually. On page 8, I have put the a copy of the letter that Lord Balfour sent to Lord Rothschild. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. So this was the letter. This was the Balfour Declaration. Go back to page 6 now. The British government, being favorable to Jewish homeland, started to meet with Zionist leaders towards the end of World War I. One important figure of that time would also become Israel's first president was Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann lived 1874-1952. Diplomacy continued to play a part in the furtherance of the Zionist agenda, and Weizmann was good at it. In 1906, Weizmann had just helped the British by sharing his recipe to better produce acetone, which was related to the production of TNT. So basically, he helped greatly with the war effort. So that was recognized. That was definitely something. You know what? This guy has really done something good here. So at least from a war perspective. So that was something that they remembered. Consequently, he became pretty close to Lloyd George, who would later become Prime Minister. But it was not until he had a meeting with Lord Arthur James Balfour that things began to crystallize. Lord Balfour is a picture on the bottom of the page here. Balfour had tried to convince Weizmann. Remember we talked about Uganda a week or 2 weeks ago when originally it was proposed to the Zionist Congress, why don't you guys move to Uganda for the Jewish homeland? And Herzl, not Weizmann, but Herzl went back and he proposed that to the Congress, and he realized that within minutes they were going to tar and feather him, yeah, and and take him out of town. So he said, "Okay, never mind, bad idea. Moving right along, let's do something else." So, but that was Herzl, and I also Balfour had tried to convince Weizmann that the Uganda proposal was a good idea, a good deal. Somehow he ended up convinced by Weizmann that only the land of Palestine would be acceptable. And from that point, he, Lord Balfour, pretty much became a Zionist. He decided that this was the right thing to do. Weizmann met Balfour again when Lloyd George was Prime Minister, and Balfour told him, "You know, I was thinking of that conversation of ours in 1906, and I believe that when the guns stop firing, you may get your Jerusalem." That was a quote from Balfour to Weizmann. I thought that was kind of cool. And I give you the sources in the notes. In 1917, Weizmann became the first president of the British Federation and worked feverishly with Lord Balfour to develop what would be known as the Balfour Declaration. This milestone, what I mean by that is they didn't work together at writing the letter. They discussed, the negotiation about what are we really trying to achieve here. And then when the agreement was when they got the agreement, then one day Balfour wrote the letter, which became known as the Balfour Declaration. Which is probably, if you think of Lord Balfour, of all the things he has done, he's remembered for this one more than anything else. And he's done other things, but this is definitely something that, his name is attached to the Balfour Declaration. This milestone for Zionism vindicated the works of Theodor Herzl, Chaim Weizmann, and other people like Nahum Sokolow, and other key Zionist leaders. Things appeared to be looking up for the Jewish people and the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. The declaration stated, well, I'm not going to read that again to you because I just read it from the letter itself. It was very short, and it said that basically Palestine was going to become a Jewish homeland. 1919, Balfour reiterated in favor of the establishment of the Jewish homeland in Palestine, And he said, and I quote, "The four great powers, Britain, France, Italy, and the United States, are committed to Zionism. And Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs and future hopes of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. In my opinion, that is right." That's pretty bold.
Yeah.
That's pretty bold right there, if you think about it. Historian, great book that if you want to pick up a good book on the Jewish people by historian Abba Eban, he said the Balfour Declaration is the decisive victory of the Jewish people in modern history. And it's a book by Abba Eban titled My People, The Story of the Jews. It's a great book. If you, so there are a few books you want to read about the Jewish people, that's definitely one of them. In 1922, following the historic move found in the Balfour Declaration, the League of Nations, now the League of Nations is simply the granddaddy of the United Nations, okay, it's the same thing. They were, I don't know when the League of Nations started. Reuben, do you have a date for that? It stopped in 45 when the League of Nations stopped and the United Nations became what it is today, replaced the League of Nations. It was in the early
1900s?
Yeah, I think it was even before that. Well, anyway, it was in the early 1900s and it lasted about 30 years or so then. So 1922, following a historic move found in the Balfour Declaration, the League of Nations approved the British mandate for Palestine, giving Britain jurisdiction over the Holy Land. And therefore authority to help with the securing of a Jewish homeland. It's not that simple, okay? We make short sentences here to explain the whole thing. It's not that simple. British mandate over Palestine, they had authority over Palestine. It didn't mean like as soon as this was done, the Jews started to go back home and that's it. We have Israel. No, that's not what happened. During World War I, two completely different promises had been made by the British government. That's the problem. And we don't have time to get in great detail because that's really beyond the scope of this class. But basically, one promise was made to the Arabs as a reward for help against the Ottoman Empire, and one to the Jewish people through the Balfour Declaration. Yes?
I'm sorry. The League of Nations began in World War I,
1919. I thought it was earlier than the Versailles Peace Conference? No. The Paris Peace, okay. So the League of Nations, you can put that next to it on top of page 9. 1919 through 1945, this is the length of the duration of the League of Nations. And then after that, it continued, but it kind of got changed. We saw that on the movie earlier tonight, and it became the United Nations. So we had, the Balfour Declaration, what started as a hopeful proposal from the British government that would look at the Jewish people and say, you know what, you've got the right to go back and we're going to do whatever we can. Now, we're not even talking about boundaries and borders. We're talking about a right to go back to the land. This was not, this was two proposals, one to the Jews, one to the Arabs, and that also the two conflicting promises would create a serious hindrance to the advancements of Zionism, not to mention force the annihilation of millions of Jewish people during World War II and the Holocaust. The trail that the early Zionists were blazing would lead to Israel, but it would turn out to be a very rocky road. What happened is that a lot of immigration was hindered because of the way things were handled. And that's to summarize it, in one sentence here. So a lot of Jewish people could have immigrated to Israel or what was then Palestine, but it was not that clear cut. So it created a lot more problems. So the Balfour Declaration is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, it started as a good thing, but it's the British kind of. It's a good thing that Lynn is not here tonight. I talk about it with her all the time, but the British really kind of turned their back on the Jewish people. No, of course not. Of course not. No. And listen, I was born in France, and how many times have I used France as an example of what the French did against the Jews? I mean, come on. I mean, it's nobody wins the medal on that one. Hold on, let me stop the recording.